Hello, you're listening to Playback Daily for Wednesday, the 10th of April. I'm Louise Herity, and here's just some of what's coming up.
But we never discuss frustration. And frustration is one of those hidden emotions that's tremendously destructive of our lives. Causes great problems, say, in the air, causes lots of burnout.
He's just one of the most beautiful superstar actors around, and I think he is the perfect match for Bruce Springsteen with his little muscular frame as well. Like he almost does look like him. So I will be watching that.
It's a small terraced house in Dublin city centre. Small footprint, two up, two down bedroom, basically, yeah. And we bought the home back in 2022, so we've kind of spent the last 18 months or so renovating the home.
We'll start with a feature that's always popular on Today with Claire Byrne, and the host was joined by Dr. Harry Barry, GP and mental health specialist, and Dr. Anne-Marie Craven from the Department of Psychology at the University of Limerick. And today's topic was frustration.
So frustration, Harry, why are we not talking about frustration? Yeah, overlooked, you think?
This frustrates me. All we're hearing at the moment is we're living in an age of anxiety. Even we were discussing it last night. And anxiety is the only word we ever hear. We hear about words like depression and shame and guilt and hurt and all that. But we never discuss frustration. And frustration is one of those hidden emotions that's tremendously destructive of our lives. Causes great problems, say, in the air, causes lots of burnout. I suppose the simplest thing to do, what is frustration?
Yeah.
You know, so frustration is very, very nicely described as discomfort anxiety. Do you know what I mean? It's basically, to put it in a nutshell, suppose I'm anxious about my Leaving Cert results. Do you know, I'm making demand, I must do well in my exams or else I'm a failure. So I'm anxious. Whereas, yeah, I go to college and I get an assignment and I'm bored. Mm-hmm. My thinking is, why the bloody hell should I have to do this assignment? This is a waste of my time. I could be doing so many other enjoyable things. So I get totally frustrated and I procrastinate. And that's fine to a point, like we all get frustrated. But it's when this becomes what we call low frustration tolerance, where it becomes the way, our way of life, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
That's when frustration really starts to become a problem. And I think it's a much, much bigger problem out there than we're discussing.
So maybe we are describing other issues,
yes,
and other emotions in a way that doesn't include the word frustration and should.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Why is that relevant then, the word frustration and the emotions around it, Anne-Marie, when it comes to conversations around mental health?
Yeah, so as Harry says, and can I say, Harry, not all college assignments are frustrating, you know. I have to get that in there, not in psychology. But, you know, frustration is this negative emotion like so many others, but we don't often have a label to talk about it in mental health conversations. And I think it's also important because we're all going to encounter situations in our life where we might have a frustrated response. So if you even think about heading home after work, you pull out of the car park, you think you have a clear run home, and maybe there's a diversion on your route. So some people will shrug their shoulders and carry on, and others might feel very frustrated, irritable or angry, and most of us somewhere in between. But the point is that situations that might cause frustration, we're going to meet those in everyday life. So we need to be able to have a very frustrated response to them. And I think another reason I find it interesting in mental health is it's a big part of irritability. So frustration is really central to irritability, and that is a feature of lots of conditions like anxiety and like depression. And we also see people who have ADHD, for example. ADHD isn't a mental health condition, but people with ADHD and other neurodivergence are often vulnerable to mental health conditions. And people with ADHD often report high levels of frustration in day-to-day life relative to others. So there's loads of reasons why thinking about frustration is important for mental health.
So Anne-Marie, if I describe it in this way, so I want something, or I want to get mm-hmm. somewhere, to use the example of the traffic, and I can't get what I want. I can't get through that traffic quickly enough. I feel frustrated. Are we talking about how I respond to what has just happened?
Yes. Yeah, you could be the negative emotional response you have to that. And it might come with behaviour on top of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you might you know, put your hands down and cross your arms and be a little frustrated like that, you might see a behavioural indicators of this emotional response. But we're all going to have an emotional response, but some people's will be a lot more exaggerated than others, and some might have this for a longer period of time. So if you even think about something that might make somebody angry, some people will think, well, look, you know, I'm a little bit angry now, but I'm going to manage my emotions, I'm going to regulate them. And others might fly off the handle. So we differ in how we respond emotionally to these events. But the point for frustration is we're all going to meet situations that might cause that kind of response in us. So it's good to talk about.
You mentioned, Harry, low frustration tolerance. What's that about?
Yes, low frustration tolerance. Now, this is one of my most favourite topics. And by the way, anybody listening here, please get out your sense of humour, because you have to have a sense of humour for this particular emotion. If I meet somebody who comes in to me, for example, and they think they're anxious, and within 5 minutes we're doing a sheet, not on their anxiety, but on their LFT, their frustration. The three key points about a person with LFT. If you find you're living your life through this lens, this is the key. The first one is, I want long-term gain, but I don't want any short-term pain. I want the situation to change, but I don't want to change anything about myself, and I want it now. Mm-hmm. If you can recognize those parameters in yourself, and if you recognize the behavior, and it's the behavior that really bothers me, it's the behavior that causes the destruction of your life and the difficulties. So suppose I'm somebody who, every time I meet a problem, suppose I'm a manager in a company, or I'm even at home with children or whatever like that, and my natural response is every time there's a problem, my natural emotion is to blow, but my behaviour is what caused the problems. I become irritable, I become short, I become bad-tempered, I take it out on the people around me, I may go into a sullen silence. Very often, say, in those wonderful college students who never get bored with their assignments, but sometimes their natural behaviour is procrastination, which they figure it's up to about 60-70% in college from mm-hmm. really not being not wanting to do it. So a very good description: if LFT is running my life is usually a mess. Mm. And it's a very common association with burnout. So we never think in terms of...
Are we talking about people who are angry with themselves?
No, they're angry with the situation. They want life to be different. So the thinking behind LFT is very simple. I don't want to suffer any discomfort. And I want people, situations and life to change to suit me.
Lazy.
Good luck. Good luck. Good luck with those two demands from life.
Anne-Marie, what do you say to all that?
Yeah, I think there's lots of terms for how we experience different emotions, and low frustration tolerance has been studied in relation to college assignments and so on, as Harry says, and also other aspects of life. I would see this pattern of low frustration tolerance just as part of the bigger picture of emotion regulation. So emotion regulation captures those processes by which we influence the emotions we have and when we have them and how we experience and express them. And having good emotion regulation skills is really important to live our lives happily and to not engage in kind of behaviours that might influence other people destructively, as Harry says. So if somebody has strong emotion regulation skills, they can manage their emotions in ways that keep them on an even keel, broadly speaking. And if they don't have strong emotion regulation skills, they will get frustrated easily, upset easily, might have these kind of difficult behaviours that accompany that. So I see it as fitting into this bigger picture of emotion regulation strategies that we all need to develop.
Mm-hmm. So we need to regulate our emotions, or we would like to be emotionally regulated. But when does that become repression of your emotions? I'm really frustrated at somebody, but I have to behave in a way that doesn't display that, Harry.
Yeah, no, I think the first thing is you're quite right, and Amy is totally correct, that the secret is to regulate our emotions. But one very important thing, we never should try to suppress an emotion. We must accept it, recognise it and accept it. And try and change then the way we look at things, because we can change our thinking and we can change our behaviour, but you should never try to go straight for the emotion. It's like saying, don't be anxious. Mm. What a ridiculous thing to say to somebody. Now, I might look at the thinking behind your anxiety and your behaviour, and similarly with frustration. So if somebody comes to me and their life is a mess, well, my attitude is, look, you're not winning at the moment at this game you're playing with your life. Your home life is a mess. Your work life is a mess. You're fighting with people. By the way, if you meet somebody on the road on the motorway who blasts you out of the way, welcome to LFT.
That's it, is it?
I happen to notice maybe
happens a lot.
It happens a lot. And I notice a lot of the cars seem to be yellow number plate, but maybe that's just sheer chance.
That is sheer chance.
That's sheer chance. But you know, but if you know, that's the classic person who is, I'm going to get it out of myself. Do you know? So what they don't realise that it's very bad for them. They're pumping out noradrenaline, their aggression hormone, and that gives rise to muscle tension, tension headaches. It also gives rise to things like, you know, cardiac arrhythmias, you know, more seriously, high blood pressure. And funny enough, I've actually seen LFT associated with depression. You know what I mean? Where the person gets so frustrated that eventually they trigger about a depression.
So what do you do? Let's use that example because it's a really good
Perfect.
One. You're driving on the motorway. You're trying to overtake. Somebody is sitting in the outside lane. And what you want to do is beep the horn, flash
Absolutely.
The light.
Lose it.
So what do you do instead of doing that?
Right. So I have three questions that I get people to do in a notebook for about 2 months. And this, by the way, solves the problem. But you really have to have a sense of humour and you have to be very disciplined to do it. So the three questions is, what's my long-term goal in this particular situation that I'm frustrated about?
Mm-hmm.
What short-term pain am I trying to avoid in this particular situation? And what changes in my thinking and my behaviour do I need to make in this situation? So if we take the example you've given me, right. My long-term goal is I want to get to my destination safely and hopefully calm. Now, my short-term pain is I could blast and go absolutely nuts, do you know what I mean? Or I could simply say, look, it's not worth the effort. I'm going to change my thinking. I can't change the behaviour of this person in front of me, mm-hmm. do you know what I mean? So I can accept what I can and or change what I can, accept what I can. If it was me, I would move in, I'd turn up the music or turn up the radio station I'm listening to, and I would sit back and let these people blast by because they're the ones who are actually going to get more frustrated because they're going to go about a mile down the road and going to hit a bigger traffic
problem
jam.
Again.
Whereas if you go at a steady, steady rate, you will get. So in other words, it's all about every time I get frustrated, standing back, looking at my behaviour, changing my behaviour, change how I think about the situation. And suddenly I find I'm not as frustrated about it.
Well, I suppose the only thing that you're not doing there, Anne-Marie, is scratching that instant itch that you had to blow off steam. And is that okay to repress that itch?
Yeah, so I wouldn't see it as repressing it. There's a difference between shifting how you express something and repressing it entirely. And I'd agree with Harry that you don't want to be repressing or suppressing emotion. That's not going to help you deal with the emotion in the moment, really. And it's not going to help you develop skills to deal with that emotion when you see it again. But you could recognise that you're someone who might be easily frustrated with situations. And in that example, of course, everyone's safety is at risk, right? As a cyclist, I often meet people who are frustrated and I catch them up at the lights pretty much every time in the village. So certainly being able to identify you're someone who is getting frustrated, but look, let's pick up on that. Let's reappraise the situation, reframe it and think what is the end goal to get somewhere safely.
I mean, what we're describing really is toddler behaviour.
It's
throwing a tantrum.
Yes. Yeah, it's quite common in toddlerhood, absolutely. And unfortunately, some of us maybe weren't supported to develop those skills as much in toddlerhood or childhood,
mm-hmm.
or maybe we're stretched a little thin in terms of other stressors. So we need more help in adulthood. And of course, we treat it differently in toddlerhood. But the tips Harry mentions are good for adults.
So there's an important lesson here for
there
parents
is.
As well, Harry.
Absolutely. Like I have parents, sometimes we do a sheet, by the way, on I'm losing it with the 6-year-old or the 5-year-old or 4-year-old because I want them to do something and they refuse to do it. So my ask you is, what's your long-term goal here? My long-term goal is, look, this is a 4 or 5 or 6 or whatever. And I want this child to grow up in as kind of calm and as sensible kind of house as possible. So I might have to say, look, you know, this is a child. I can't change their behaviour, do you know what I mean, because of their age. So maybe I'm the person who has to change and back off and just come out of the situation, turn up the music
and relax.
And relax.
Easier
and
said than done sometimes.
I think
Dr. Harry Barry and Dr. Anne-Marie Craven on Today with Clare Byrne. Muslims across Ireland are celebrating Eid this week, and it marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Reporter Mark O'Driscoll was at the Islamic Cultural Centre of Ireland in Clonskee in Dublin this morning for this report on Morning Ireland.
Yes, hello from a busy and wet Islamic Cultural Centre of Ireland this morning. However, the rain has not been dampening people's spirits here, let me tell you. The car park has been full since around 7 a.m. this morning. This is actually the first year that two separate prayer sessions have been organised to cope with the crowds. Roughly 7,000 people are expected to attend prayers here this morning, and I spoke to some of the people who were on their way into prayers a little earlier on.
Definitely like coming together as a community, you know, you see everyone, because it's such a special day. Everyone, some people that you haven't seen in a while, they're still going to gather up on this day. It's maybe someone you haven't seen in a couple of months or even a year, you know. It's just coming together as a community, such a special feeling after such a long month of fasting, you know what I mean, going through what other people have to go through throughout the whole year on a daily basis, and then like finishing it off with the celebrations, you know what I mean? Another thing, probably the food as well. I'm going to be honest with you. All the sweets that my mum makes in the morning, we'd be having and all that.
Actually, it's like, you know, a quite exciting thing to celebrate Ramadan, because you fast for 30 days and then it's suddenly Ramadan, and then you get to enjoy with your friends. And then the most important thing is that you give people charity. So that is the most important thing.
In my home country, like, we usually gather together with family. So it's one of the two biggest celebrations in Islam. So the best part is kind of we are all together, we kind of have quality time.
Today I'm here for Eid prayer with my family, and then after this I have people coming over for breakfast, and then we're gonna have like a little nap in the evening, and then we're gonna have people over for like lunch as well. I feel like this was my quickest Ramadan so far. I had like school as well, so it went by so quickly I barely even noticed it go by, and I'm grateful that it's Eid now.
What's your favourite part now of today?
Well, when I was younger, it might have been like the activities, but now it's the prayer itself.
What sort of presents then would children or yourselves get?
Clothes, sweets, money, toys, anything.
Was it a tough Ramadan?
No, it wasn't, to be honest. It was one of the easiest Ramadan because of the daylight hours that we fasted. Not as tough as maybe it was during the summer a couple of years ago, to be honest. The togetherness of the community as well, you know, makes it more special.
Yes, some of the 7,000 people there who are expected to attend prayers at the Islamic Cultural Centre of Ireland in Clonskee this morning. Joining me now is the spokesperson for the centre, Dr. Ali Salim. Dr. Ali, thank you for speaking to me this morning. You're a man in demand there. Lots of people popping up to wish you Eid Mubarak. A very important day in the Islamic calendar today.
It is a very important day. In the very beginning, I'd like to wish Eid Mubarak to Muslims all over the world, and particularly the Muslim community in Ireland. Muslim community in Ireland has rapidly increased to the extent that we're not having one prayer as we do every year. We're having two prayers despite the fact of the rapid increase of the Islamic organizations all over Ireland. So Eid Mubarak to all the community here.
Lots of people turned out for the first prayer session here this morning at 8 a.m. You're getting ready now for a second session at 10 a.m, but you've also lots of other activities organised here.
Yes, it is the day of celebration, so we have a number of activities for children, like face painting and balloons and all that stuff. You see, so it's the time for socialization for members of the Muslim community, and it's also time for Muslim children to celebrate and integrate.
And lots of Muslims will be taking today off, and indeed maybe the next 2 days off. What sort of activities, or how will they celebrate when they get home this afternoon and evening?
Well, we start our celebration by coming to the mosque to offer a prayer, since our festivals are marked by offering an act of worship in advance. So we have been fasting, refraining from all foods and drinks from dawn until sunset throughout the entire month of Ramadan. And we start our celebration by coming to the mosque here to pray. After that, you'll see Muslim families around tea and coffee stations here, toys distributed for children. They stay here for some time, and then Muslim families, they have their own activities. They gather together in houses and they go to open places. If the weather allows, I hope it will allow them to do that today, but I would expect them to be in community centers, Muslim houses, sharing the celebration of their very special day, Eid al-Fitr.
Dr. Ali Saleem, thank you very much. That's it from the Islamic Cultural Centre of Ireland in Clonskeath this morning. Hopefully the sun will turn out, and Eid Mubarak.
Mark O'Driscoll reporting on Morning Ireland. The winner of this year's Home of the Year, dubbed the Boutique Abode by the judges, was a mid-terrace in Dublin. And Oliver Callan spoke to the homeowners, Shane Murray and Marty Campbell.
Morning, how are you?
Good morning to you. For those who watch, I'll come to Marty first of all. For those who haven't been watching the show, can you describe the type of house, Marty?
Hey, yeah, it's a small terraced house in Dublin city centre. Small footprint, two up, two down bedroom, basically, yeah. And we bought the home back in 2022, so we kind of spent the last 18 months or so renovating the home.
I think it was lovely that this is such a home that's very recent to you, that's only in the last 2 years. And you must have gone straight in renovating, or what was there? There's an interesting story here, because obviously you were planning to get married at one stage, weren't you?
Yeah, well, we originally were planning to get married in 2020, but obviously COVID happened, and we postponed the wedding to 2021. Still COVID, so we decided, you know what, let's use the money to buy our first home. We kind of spent the end of the next 18 months renovating the home. So yeah,
and it's in Dublin.
Dublin city centre, yeah.
Dublin city centre, brilliant. And did you use designers, interior architects, any of those kind of people?
No, we pretty much did it all ourselves. Yeah.
Lovely.
So Shane could take this one, actually. Shane's the designer, so he comes from a design background.
Shane, congratulations. It's all yours.
Thank you.
Marty did nothing, is what he's kind of saying there.
Marty just okayed everything and vetoed some things. Yeah, I suppose it was mainly my vision and my design kind of ideas. I knew I kind of wanted something bold, something that people talk about, something it's Marmite, some people don't particularly like it. Yeah. So I suppose I from the very beginning, I wanted something that kind of packed, as Sarah said, packed a punch, you know, kind of was a talking point.
And do you have a background in design? You've some kind of training, do you?
Well, I did interior design in college. I did a degree back in 2000, and we finished in 2009, but I never worked in it. I went on to become I'm a baker now, so
you're a baker.
It's kind of still creative, yeah. So it's completely different, but creative. I suppose I have an academic background in it, but I've never worked in it.
And come here, I'm fascinated about the baking, because that'll put you in line for another reality show. Work for yourself,
yeah,
or do you?
I do. I own a wholesale baking business, so I supply coffee shops with cakes and.
That's
fascinating.
Yeah,
it's a nice job.
Yeah, so it ticks all the creative boxes then you're doing.
Yes, absolutely.
That's probably why there's two ovens in the house, is it?
Absolutely. Well, you can't cook Christmas dinner with one oven, so that's why I wanted to.
Oh, I beg to differ. I think people around the country are kind of...
Yeah.
Marty, of course you can, yeah. Marty, come in here and defend the rest of the nation. By the way, Marty, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say about Shane's design, and his was very much about his our personality as well.
Yeah.
I wanted to get that across in the home. So things like his love for baking and cooking, hence the two ovens for sure.
I was worried for you initially, because I heard you say, oh, I thought this could have been should have been brighter colours at the start of the final last night, which almost hinted that it wasn't going to be the final winner.
Yeah, we were pretty surprised. Yeah. Not surprised, I suppose we knew the outcome, but when we were watching our episode, to see Hugh kind of have be a bit kind of unsure about the colours at the beginning we were a bit surprised at that. But I suppose it is that kind of house that, as Amanda said, it's about how you feel when you're in it, more so than looking at pictures of it. So a lot of the pictures didn't do the justice of how you felt when you're actually in the space.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and we love that kind of dark and broody colours, you know, and that was really what we wanted to stick to when we were kind of coming up with the colour palette for the home. We kind of said, you know, this is what we like, so we wanted to make sure that kind of then stayed throughout the home as well.
Hugh was kind of cynical enough, wasn't he, particularly about the position of the television.
TV gate, what we call it.
TV gate, okay.
Yeah, to be fair, he had a good point, I suppose, for such a small room, you know, we kind of decided that was a place that
it's
we could...
It's over the fireplace, isn't it? It's
just
too high.
It works for us, so it does. But we know, we take his point.
You've got so much baking to do.
Yeah, I suppose in terms of the height, he was talked about the fireplace being a faux fireplace, but it's actually, we like the idea of having the centerpiece in the room of the fireplace.
Yeah,
it goes back to the traditional house, obviously, and then I suppose it just made sense for us to put the TV above us. It was a funny thing for him to pick up on, and I would love to know from Hugh where else in the room he would have put it.
Yeah, I suppose it's supposed to be at eye level when you're sitting down, so he's probably thinking left or right.
But it's on an arm that tilts down, so it's perfect for us. Like, it works perfectly for us.
Oh, it tilts down. Okay, we didn't see that.
Yeah.
I'm with you on this. I'm sorry. You're just wrong. You're just wrong.
Yeah.
Marty, you're from Northern Territories.
Originally from Tyrone, but I've been living in Dublin now the last 10 years or so. But I'm still a blow-in, really.
Oh, wow. So there were actually two Tyrone people in the final last night.
Yeah, Peter's home. Yeah, Peter's, the Gate Lodge in Tyrone, which is a stunning property. We love that one. Yeah. So, and there was an obviously in Derry as well, the rectory in Derry.
I know from inside here that there was huge interest from the media in the north on this year's Home of the Year, and they were slightly disappointed when they discovered a Dublin home won. But of course, when they discovered one of the owners is from Tyrone, those things matter.
They could give him 50% to the win there, sure, yeah.
You haven't told us what the budget was, and some people do, some people don't.
Now that
you're the winners, you have this extra responsibility.
I suppose we didn't have a budget in a way, because of the way we decorated or we renovated. It was very much kind of as we go along. We didn't have one contractor come in with a number, and we had to pay that amount. So I suppose in that way we didn't have a budget, not because we just had unlimited money, but because we just did it kind of bit by bit as we had money to do different things.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was important. Like, we didn't have an architect, we didn't have an interior design. You know, it was very much a DIY job. So I suppose we kind of did it in stages and kind of controlled the budget or what money we had, and kind of did it when we could. Yeah.
And I suppose people, what state was it in when you got there?
The home hadn't been lived in a few years, so it was pretty state of disrepair. Yeah, so we couldn't move in straight away. So I think we spent the first 3 months since we picked up the keys. So we did the bedroom and some ground floor work, but when we moved in, it was still very much a building site. So we spent our first winter here kind of living in a building site, and then doing room by room then over the course of the year then.
Well, I suppose people can guess as well the fact that you didn't get married. You put the money into the renovation, so they can look up the average cost of wedding, or guess from your home how much you might have spent on the wedding. Yeah. Are the marriage plans still in train?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I think into next year we're going to plan something.
Oh, brilliant.
Winners of this year's Home of the Year on RTE1, Shane Murray and Marty Campbell chatting to Oliver Callan. The start and finish lines of the Dublin Marathon this year are staying within the city centre after race organisers and the City Council agreed a plan which it's hoped will keep disruption to a minimum. Brian Dobson had the story on the News at One.
Last year's race route attracted controversy following criticism of its impact on public transport. We can speak now to Jim Ockney, who's race director for the Irish Life Dublin Marathon 2024. Jim, you're very welcome to the programme. Thanks for taking our call. So what's been announced today?
Thank you very much. Yes, we've unveiled that the new finish line will be in Mount Street, just above the Pepper Canister Church. For anybody that's familiar with that area, the start line is moving around the corner into Leeson Street, and by and large, the route for 2020 that we used in 2023 will be maintained for 2024. So we've made slight changes to the start and finish, mostly in a similar footprint than that we had for last year's event, with the small tweaks.
This issue arose because the National Transport Authority were concerned at what they described as a disproportionate adverse impact on transport services in the city. Now, how has that been addressed?
Yes, again, we post last year's event, we sat down with Dublin City Council, and again, we all agreed that to try and keep the event in the city as a city centre marathon was a priority for everybody. But yes, we've moved off Merrion Square North to give a throughput to more buses for Dublin Bus and the National Transport Authority. So again, that main artery is freed up now on the Friday and the Saturday, which we hope will have a positive impact for them in 2024. But for the runner itself, to move around the corner into Leeson Street gives them a cleaner start right onto Stephen's Green, and proving still an iconic finish in the city centre, just above the Pepper Canister Church. So I think the city wins in that the event is still in the city centre, with a lot of people travelling to Dublin, booking accommodation. The Transport Authority wins that they get certain arteries freed up, and the runner wins in that we have a similar footprint and a better start area.
And that, I mean, that really, from your point of view, was vital, was it, that the start and finish was in the city centre, that it wouldn't be moved out to one of the suburbs?
Absolutely. When we sat down with Dublin City Council, it was one of the main objectives we both had, to be quite honest, to maintain a city centre marathon. Every other city in Europe and around the world has an iconic city centre marathon as part of their events throughout the year. So to maintain, to keep that, was very important to Dublin City Council and ourselves, and we're delighted that that has been maintained.
So that's the start and the finish then, Jim, and then the actual route will it be the same as last year?
We have to make a small change on the route because the start has moved forward a little bit, but it's the route for 2023 will be maintained, other than a slight change just after the start line. And again, we'll be revealing that when we get the route officially measured, that we can then announce it. But it's only a very, very small change early in the event, and runners will be back on track then, the 2 mile mark all the way into the finish. They would normally cross the canal and run straight into Merrion Square North. This year they'll turn left along the canal and then turn right into Mount Street. So the runners will be very familiar with the route. There's only very slight changes to it, which we're delighted to maintain.
Just before I let you go, people will be aware that there's huge demand for the marathon each year. At this stage, have you opened applications? Where do you stand on that?
Well, we opened applications almost immediately after last year's event. We had 31,000 people looking for lottery places, and we had 12,000 that actually received priority codes because they ran before. So we had over 40,000 looking for 22,500 places. So it's well and truly sold out for 2024, which we're delighted to see the interest in the event.
All right. Well, it's good to hear that agreement has been reached as well. Jim, thanks very much indeed. Jim Orkney there from the Dublin City Marathon.
And Jim was chatting to Brian Dobson on the News at One today. New York-based Irish fashion designer Laura Webber made headlines in 2021 when First Lady Jill Biden wore some of her designs to her husband's US presidency inauguration. She's now dressing the Irish Olympians for the 2024 Games in Paris this summer. And she chatted to Oliver Callan today.
Good morning.
Congratulations on all your amazing work. Obviously, the dressing or being involved in the dressing of Dr. Jill Biden must have been a very significant moment for you.
Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic. I always say it, you know, it was never a thought when I was doing the work. I did the embroidery on her dress, jacket and mask for the inauguration. And it was never a thought up until the point of it being out in the public. And that's when things got wild.
Yeah, you're kind of so focused on the job, you don't think of what's going to happen afterwards.
Exactly. The work is so important for me, and the outcome is so important. And, you know, keeping the designer happy is so important and the client happy. So it was never a thought up until the moment.
It's great to have, because the Bidens are so detailed about ensuring Irish connections to nearly everything they do. It was lovely to have that on the day.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the Irish Olympians, because that's obviously going to be another big deal for you. It's obviously Paris this year. How did you get involved in designing and designing the outfits for the Irish Olympians?
Well, I approached the council, the Olympic council, back in 2021 with an idea. And I think that it really came from a place of just wanting the Olympians to look and feel their absolute best.
Yes.
And through the process, you know, there was changes, there was ideas, there was, you know, bettering the idea. And we finally got to a point where, you know, everybody was happy. And working with the athletes themselves and getting to meet them, I mean, what they do, I don't think I fully realized the effort, perseverance, the discipline of what they actually go through. Like, their entire lives are dedicated to this.
Yeah.
And it was just such a moving moment for me to be able to collaborate with them, to be able to work with the council, to just get to this place. It's just been so humbling, and it's, you know, it's been incredible, honestly.
Years and years of effort, but you've worked for a couple of years as well on just this project.
Yes, yes. Since 2021, we've been working on the Olympic uniforms.
So you've been sitting on the secret for a long time.
Yeah, it's funny because I can't believe it's really here.
Do we have a history of Irish designers addressing our Olympians for the ceremonies?
We do. There's been Paul Costello and John Rocha have been involved in the 2000s. But, you know, this is a really momentous occasion for the Olympics because Ireland competed for the first time in 1924. So
course,
it's 100
yes.
years of the Olympics. And it was in Paris. So I think that this is just so monumental, not for, you know, not just for the Olympians themselves, but for Ireland.
Yeah.
And it's just such an incredible moment.
It's great as well. 1924 in Paris, Jack B. Yeats won a silver Olympic medal for art. I think the Liffey Swim was the painting.
Yes, exactly.
His art was in the Olympics at the time. It should be back. It should be back. And indeed, fashion should be there as well.
I know.
Some other countries as well.
I know, it should.
Big designers involved. So you're in good company here, aren't you, for the other Olympians in other nations?
Yes, yes. I'm definitely in great company. You know, USA has Ralph Lauren, Italy's put forward incredible designers. You know, there's France is obviously up there with Louis Vuitton and Berluti, and it's just amazing.
Yes, Armani is doing the national uniform teams for Italy. So what is your brief for the Olympians? You're dressing them specifically for the ceremonies, is that right?
Exactly. So I will be dressing them for opening ceremony and closing ceremony. Mm-hmm. And what we have done is we've obviously researched years and years and years of Olympic uniforms. And we took a 1920s style blazer for the women's, but we actually made it out of a recycled material. It's an eco-hybrid taffeta. And it's a patented fabric. And what was really important was there was a sustainability element, but also the athletes felt, you know, contemporary and modern. And so we took that silhouette of a traditional blazer mixed with a new fabric. It has shoulder pads, it has lapels. And then for the men's jacket, what we did was we combined more of a traditional jacket, but with a moto jacket. So it's a little bit more of a relaxed fit.
It's more casual looking.
But we have, you know, yeah, exactly. We have, you know, an opera ticket pocket on their front, but it fits an iPhone. So there's just like little hints of elements that are, you know, design specific.
And very practical. It's made, is it 100% made from recycled plastic bottles? Is that the case for the blazer?
Yes, recycled t-shirts and PET bottles.
Right. And that's going to be nice and cool because obviously they're worried about heat waves over the summer in Paris.
Exactly. So for the opening ceremony, they'll be on a boat going down the Seine. And so the fabric is moisture permeable and water wicking. So it's really nice and breathable. And we've also added eyelets for, you know, for extra breathability.
Very good. And it's all white.
It is all white, but what I say is it's this modern contemporary take on the Greek games. And what we've done is we've added really, really small hints of colour. So on the side panel, there's an orange, a deep, deep, deep orange insert. And then what we have on the piping on one of the legs is the Irish flag. And on the back of the jackets, I have embroidered the word Ireland, mm-hmm. but it's done in a technique that is tufted. So it's almost like raised texture of embroidery, and it mimics grass. So that's how we interpreted Ireland. And it's actually embroidered on a handwoven tweed. So there's really, really small elements of colour, but still that contemporary modern feel.
And you've done something really nice, which I have never seen before, which is you've given a nod to the county they come from on the sleeve.
Yes. So every athlete got to choose what county they wanted embroidered on their sleeve. And so what we've done is we've interpreted the county emblems themselves, and we've made them into patches and embroidered those on each sleeve of each athlete. Wow. I think this is probably my favourite part of the uniform, honestly, because it's going to be such a lovely moment for the athletes to compare their artwork on their sleeves. And it just gives it that little bit of uniqueness and special to them.
That is just such a good idea. And you've got they're unique as well, the graphic that you've created for each county.
Exactly. Yeah, we've interpreted the artwork ourselves with a little bit of a modern take. And we've toned down all the colours to more of a pastel. And so it blends in really nicely with the white uniform. And it was just important to take that interpretation of the artwork and really make it our own.
That's a lovely idea. And the shoes?
So what I did with the shoes was I took a more vintage style tennis shoe and I layered vulcanized rubber in different sheens on the base of the actual shoe itself. And then we have the logo, the Olympic logo, on the tongue of the shoe. And the shoe is actually made from Nappa leather.
Right.
And it has a brogue wax lace. So we were really excited to do the shoes too, because we felt like we were able to just complete the whole look.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just a really important part of the whole uniform as well.
No, you've done an amazing job. And there's quite a lot of Olympians you had to dress for this occasion.
Yes. I think that I wasn't fully, you know, I hadn't fully thought through how much talent we have in the country.
There's over about 120, aren't there, going to Paris?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Around 120. There's still some qualifiers. But, I mean, the talent, I mean, on a world stage, Ireland is just exceeding and excelling in so many departments. I mean, in arts and film and music. And just to see the talent of sport was so humbling. I mean, to even just see what they do and how they live and how they dedicate their entire lives to this, to the sport, is just phenomenal.
It was great. And it's our biggest contingent ever going there. So I'm so glad the Olympic Federation came up with the idea of getting such special Irish designs done for them. You've got something different as well for the closing ceremony.
Yes. So for the closing ceremony, what we've done is we've taken a vintage 80s and 90s style tracksuit jacket. And what we've done, it's like very track star. And what we wanted to do for the closing is it's a little bit more fun. It's a little bit more, you know, it's a celebration at the end.
Yeah.
And what I designed was a strapping that goes around the neck. Mm-hmm. And from a bird's eye view, it looks like a star. And then
this is the clever bit.
When they wear a medal, it finishes the point of the star.
That's such a brilliant idea.
And thank you.
It's great because there are lots of drone shots and everything, aren't they, at all these ceremonies now. So we'll get to see that, and we hope to see a couple of stars from overhead.
Exactly.
Irish fashion designer Laura Weber talking to Oliver Callan. With the release of Back to Black, the Amy Winehouse biopic this week, Claire Byrne wanted to chat about some of the best and worst biopics. She was joined by Edel Coffey, author and columnist with the Irish Examiner, and Brian Lloyd, movies editor with entertainment.ie, to discuss.
I think it's great. I mean, if you haven't seen The Bear, it's been one of the best TV shows, I think, in the last, I would say, 5-10 years. It's
excellent.
It's fantastic. And
a bit stressful.
But but that's the point. Yeah. I mean, you even look at it, the sort of smaller roles that he's done over the years, like in Shameless or most recently in The Iron Claw, where he was part of this ensemble cast. He was playing this professional wrestler. He's brilliant. Like, he really does bring that kind of intensity. And as I understand it, the biopic will be about the Nebraska album, which was the boss's like first kind of like solo album. Mm-hmm. He was kind of going through a bit of a rough period in his own career and stuff like that. So it's a very interesting point of, you know, Springsteen's career to choose to make a film out of. But I'm actually looking forward to this one.
Okay, so we're happy with that. Adele, are you happy with that?
Absolutely. I was thinking of this New Yorker cartoon that appeared quite recently, where you have this post-coital couple in bed and one of the pair turns to the other and says, "That was great, but what was all that Yes Chef stuff about?" And I just think it was perfectly encapsulated the sort of iconography of Jeremy Allen White. He's just one of the most beautiful superstar actors around, and I think he is the perfect match for Bruce Springsteen with his little muscular frame as well. Like, he almost does look like him. So I will be watching that.
Okay, well, we don't even need to review that now. We've decided that that's going to be excellent. So Brian, you've watched the Amy Winehouse biopic, have you? Back to Black.
Mm.
What did you think?
Not a whole lot of it.
I can tell by your face.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, I'm not really sure that a biopic was needed of Amy Winehouse's life. I mean, it's Jen Gannon, a journalist, wrote a great piece about it a few years back, and she basically made the same point I would agree with, which is that it's not as if Amy Winehouse's life and career is, you know, ancient history. I mean, her contemporaries are still in the charts. Do we really need to kind of see her life kind of fictionalized and brought back to the public consciousness? You know, like, I mean, you look at, say, like Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, for example. I mean, part of the reason why he made that is because he felt that Elvis was just as relevant now as he was back in the 50s and the 60s, and that the same kind of level of, I guess, popular culture stranglehold that he had was the same as, you know, anyone you want to mention nowadays. But yeah, I mean, Marissa Abella, who plays Amy Winehouse, I think she does a good job. And it's a kind of a thankless task, though, because everyone remembers Amy Winehouse. Everyone has an opinion on this film, and everyone has an opinion on how the whole thing went down. Eddie Marsden plays Mitch Winehouse. Jack O'Connell plays Blake Fielder Civil. I would say they're both very, very sympathetically portrayed compared to, say, Asif Kapadia's documentary Amy, where they more or less allege that Mitch Winehouse had effectively exploited his daughter over the years. In this, it's very much a case of, you know, Mitch Winehouse was this very doting, caring father, but was kind of a little bit hand-off with her, you know, and sort of left her to her own discretion. The way that Jack O'Connell plays Blake Fielder Civil, you know, he's this kind of roguish, charismatic bon vivant, you know.
Mm. And others have objected to that portrayal.
Yeah,
as well,
completely.
Of him, because they've almost made a Hollywood type.
Oh,
icon,
no, they absolutely.
From him.
Yeah, absolutely, they have. And like, this is the thing, I can see why people have problems with this.
Yeah.
I remember when I was watching it, I was thinking, it's the sort of thing that they are so afraid of offending anybody. They're so terrified of, you know, getting on the bad side of anyone, of portraying anyone in a negative light, that ultimately they don't really have anything to say about anyone involved in it. I mean, the only people that kind of get a bad run on it is the paparazzi in the media, which, surprise, surprise, mm-hmm. they always do in these kind of things. And that's not to say for a second that they're not guilty. They absolutely were. I mean, the only way to describe how the media portrayed and how the media followed Amy Winehouse is predatory. But
you feel there was more to the story than
there was
you got
far
here.
More, far, far more, yeah.
Okay, Adele, let's look at some of the others now that you have picked. And you've gone with an unusual one, I think, in Cillian Murphy's Oppenheimer. I mean, does this qualify in your view as a biopic?
Well, I think it does, because it is based on a real person. And I think, just getting back to Brian's point there about how important it is for a little bit of mystery to be there for the viewer's enjoyment. With Amy Winehouse, we still all know her story. We know it so well. It was played out in the tabloids week after week. So, you know, it's in living memory. Whereas with Oppenheimer, I don't think I knew who Oppenheimer was before this film came out. I think he was probably famous at the time. He's probably still famous amongst scientists and people who know about physics. But for the average everyday person, I don't think he was a household name. And now he is. But key to the enjoyment of this film for me was I was learning about a story that I didn't know. I didn't know this story so well. And I think that's a really key part to a successful biopic. Enough time has elapsed for us not to know the full story, mm-hmm. for us to have a little bit of mystery there in the narrative as it plays out. Now, Cillian Murphy obviously transformed himself physically for this role. He lost 28 pounds or so it's said. He's never said what it is, because obviously there's reasons for that. But he listened to Oppenheimer's lectures and tried to sort of follow his life in a way, including reading the Bhagavad Gita, which is the 700-verse Hindu religious text that Oppenheimer would often quote from. And he smoked fake cigarettes, because as you can see from Cillian Murphy in the film, he's rail thin, which is also what the actual Oppenheimer was. Apparently he existed on a diet of martinis and cigarettes. So yeah, I'd say it took a lot of work to get that physique.
A bit of method acting in there.
Absolutely.
We're going back to 1995 now, Anthony Hopkins as Nixon. So we're going to take a listen to a clip from that before we chat about this. This is Nixon's team telling him about the possibility of impeachment.
Mr. President.
Huh?
Sir, Congress is... sir... Congress is considering four articles of impeachment.
Yeah. For what? They're very serious charges, sir. Huh? First, abuse of power.
Yeah.
Second, the obstruction of justice.
Yeah, what else?
Third, the failure to cooperate with the Congress.
Yeah.
And last, bombing Cambodia, sir.
They can't impeach me for bombing Cambodia. The president can bomb anybody he likes.
That's true. Well, we'll win that one, sir, but the other three...
Hey, you know, Fred, they sell tickets.
It's wrong.
They sell tickets to an impeachment like a damn circus. Okay, so they're impeaching me. Well, f*** them.
Gosh, I was really getting into that.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, it's a great scene. Yeah, it's a brilliant scene. And like right after that, when he talks about, like, you know, the president can bomb anyone he likes, he opens up the door and he goes into this reception for Vietnam War veterans. And he's just like, he's able to, like, his face just completely changes, where he turns on the big, like, rictus grin smile, yeah. And he's glad handing everybody. I mean, like, when you watch Nixon, and it's directed by Oliver Stone, like, he's not exactly known for being a subtle director. Like, he really does play with big, broad strokes in this, and it does have a very operatic tone. I mean, the way that Anthony Hopkins plays it, he matches the tenor of it as well. So he is, at times, comes across very kind of cartoonishly evil in parts, you know. But I think he just completely transforms himself, you know, that sort of way. Like, he's got the shoulders hunched over, you know, the way the face kind of lifts and drops. And even just the sort of tenor of speaking that Nixon had, Hopkins has it. And I think it's one of his best roles. I think the fact that he didn't get nominated for it and didn't win, I think, is an absolute crying shame. Because, you know, it's very much in conversation, I think, with JFK, which was the film I think he made, it was shortly after JFK that he made Nixon, because, you know, whereas JFK was this sort of seen as this beacon of light and, you know, the potential of American, and was all, you know, American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm.
Nixon's the opposite.
Nixon was the opposite. And there's that great line from Nixon, which is, you know, people look at, when he looks at the portrait of JFK, and it's again very operatic, and he says, you know, people look at you and they see what they could be. They look at me and they see what they are. And that really was what Nixon was. He was this sort of, like, I guess, stalking horse for mm-hmm. American imperialism, you know?
All right. Right, well, let's move along now to that question around, you know, portraying a real person. I mean, you mentioned there, you know, that cartoonishly yeah. element that you can kind of see when people take it too far. That's a real risk, isn't it, when you're taking on the life of a real person and putting it on screen?
Yeah, absolutely. And there is some sort of magical alchemy that exists between mimicry and imitation, and then the people who actually get it right. Because I do think, to play a real person, you have to get their mannerisms, you have to study those things that made them them. And you know, it's important that you look a little bit like them too, even if that means including prostheses in your performance, which I know are kind of controversial now. But one of my favourite roles is Nicole Kidman playing Virginia Woolf in mm-hmm. The Hours. And I know that's not technically a biopic, but I think the role is wonderful. But yeah, I think it's a sort of mysterious art, really, because you can get all the mannerisms right and you can still fail. One of my least favourite performances would be Kristen Stewart as Diana in that film, Spencer. It's, for me, it was just bonkers. She had plenty of Diana's mannerisms, but it was just, it felt like almost a joke. And that is the problem.
Work.
It tips over into parody mm-hmm. when you don't get it right. Well, but as to why it goes wrong, I think that's a mysterious thing. And I think people only realise when it's on the screens and it's too late.
That seems to be the case. I mean, there's another royal one that didn't quite work for you either. I know that's Olivia Colman playing the Queen.
Yes.
And we have a clip. This is her telling Charles to make his marriage work.
All anyone wants is for the pair of you to pull yourselves together. Stop making spectacles of yourselves and make this marriage and your enormously privileged positions in life work.
And if I want to separate?
You will not separate or divorce or let the side down in any way. And if one day you expect to be king?
I do.
Then might I suggest you start to behave like one?
See, I love Olivia Colman.
I do too, but I just think she was wrong for this role.
Yeah.
And I think her performance, I think she was going for something. Like, I think she was trying to make the Queen a little more ordinary in her personal life. Mm-hmm. But for me, I just never didn't see Olivia Colman. I never saw the Queen. I always saw Olivia Colman.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier amongst ourselves here. And Claire Foy, I think, was so good in that role
that it was really difficult
for anyone coming after her.
I agree. And I think that's another problem. If you've got sort of landmark films or TV series that portray like a real high point of that character, you've really got your work cut out for you mm-hmm. afterwards.
Naomi Watts as Diana didn't work for you either.
Wow, I remember actually going to the press screening of that, and there was people actually rolling in the aisles laughing about how terrible it was. It was
film critics are very harsh.
We are, yeah, of course we are, yeah. But like, I mean, to be fair, that film was absolutely diabolical in every way, shape, and form. Like Naveen Andrews playing the heart surgeon. I mean, there was one line that sticks out to me. Goes, you know, sometimes when I'm doing the surgery, it feels like I'm not even there at all. It's performing itself, and I remember people just were rolling, laughing, awful. And I mean, you know, it's nothing against Naomi Watts. She's a very, very gifted actor, but I think that film was just so entirely misjudged and just so tone deaf. You know, that sort of way, like it was portraying Princess Diana as this, you know, hopeless romantic. And I suppose in some respects she was, but I mean, it just didn't work at all. Mm-hmm. And again, I think Adele's point is very well. It's never anything something specific. Like you could look at something like, say, Frost Nixon, for example. And Michael Sheen doesn't look anything at all like David Frost, but he really got that performance absolutely correct. And then you look at Naomi Watts and Diana, and she had all the mannerisms down, looked very like her, but just completely didn't work on screen.
And that point that Adele made, that sometimes, well, it seems that, you know, it's not seen that it doesn't work until it's out there
in
the cinema.
Yeah, that's it. Until the final moment when it's actually...
How does that happen?
I mean, this is it. I think a lot of it is probably people convincing themselves like, no, we're getting this right. This will work. Like, and I think even for actors as well, because they, you know, there's such a mystique now around method acting and, you know, the lengths that people go to, and they're spending 6 months out in the desert learning how to talk to kangaroos and whatever, that they think then when they come in and actually perform it, that they're getting it. When the reality of it is that it's kismet.
Brian Lloyd from entertainment.ie and Adele Coffey, author and columnist with the Irish Examiner, on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.